As Richard noted, a very tangible theme quickly emerged from our lectionary scripture readings this week: trees, plants, and things that grow. From the prophet Ezekiel, we hear of God taking a small, tender branch from the top of a mighty cedar and planting it on the mountain of Israel, where it grows to a noble tree. The psalmist also takes inspiration from the cedar, but also the palm tree. To the author, the righteous flourish like these beautiful trees. And of course, we heard in Mark two parables about seeds that grow in the field to be harvested, and the famously large mustard shrub that grows from a tiny seed. I'm among the many who very quickly run to the interpretation of these passages as strictly parables and metaphors for our Christian institutions and relationships, which they are, but without first taking a moment to recognize something rather essential about these references, that these and many other biblical reflections upon God come from a deep attention to the created world around them, the land, the rivers and lakes, plants and animals, whether wild or domestic. The biblical imagination demonstrates not a disinterest in the world around them, but a deep and growing intimacy with it. The Bible witnesses to the understanding that creation reflects the Creator, which I think every prayer this morning began with Creator. It was just, I don't know, it's beautiful. Who, after speaking it into being, looked at it all and called it very good. Yet this is not just creation in general that is very good, but the creation in particular. As we heard, it is not trees in general that inspired the biblical writers, but cedar trees, palm trees, mustard shrubs. These are trees and plants of the ancient Near East, of the particular lands of Israel, Palestine, and Lebanon. We could say that it was through their land and the creatures that dwelt with them that God helped to shape their identity and imagination and revealed glimpses of who God is. Their land was so a part of who they knew themselves to be and who they knew their God to be, that when they were violently seized from it and brought to live exiled as second-class peoples in the land of Babylon, they lamented, as in Psalm 197, "How can we sing songs of the Lord in a foreign land?" I think for many of us, as heartbreaking as those words in the Psalms are, they also seem a little bit absurd, don't they? How can you not sing songs of the Lord in a foreign land? What's the big deal? Just sing the songs. What does it matter where you are, which land you happen to be in? Isn't God the same everywhere? The answer to that last question is, of course, yes. God is the same everywhere, but that doesn't mean that human beings are the same everywhere. The Jewish lament in Psalm 137 arises not just from being forced to be somewhere they don't want to be, but from the actual strangeness of that place to them. It wasn't their home. The land of Babylon was unrecognizable in ways. They didn't know the plants, the rivers, the animals, languages, stories, and history of that place. God wasn't displaced. They were displaced. Their homeland wasn't just a jurisdiction to them that contained a plot of private property that was legally theirs. It was the very particular soil and water and life that had mediated their creator and redeemer to them for generations. In their land, they could point to particular places and recall the works of God that took place in that river or by that well, or in that forest, or in that valley, or upon that mountaintop. The olives and figs from their trees, the grapes from their vines, the wheat and lentils from their fields, the lambs from their hillsides, the flowers of the meadows, the varieties of birds, doves, quail, ravens, sparrows, even the insects, bees, locusts, ants, gnats, they all carried story, identity, memory, and relationship. Through that land, they felt the mysterious yet unrelenting love of God. God was there with them in Babylon too, But as they were lost and disconnected from their land, they felt disconnected from their God and disconnected from themselves. They had to slowly come to know God in new ways in that foreign land. I say all this as I have, in recent years, wondered about the ways in which this same creating and redeeming God is shown in this land, here, where the vast prairies begin to rise towards the towering Rocky Mountains, here where the Bow River and the Elbow River join together, here where buffalo used to roam and the Chinook winds melt the frozen lands. We're not used to asking that question, I think. We have inherited a form of Christianity that usually disregards the land upon which we walk, seeing it mostly as a resource or a commodity of sorts. I'm as guilty as anyone else of becoming possessive of my own little tract of private property and obsessing over its economic value. But I'm entirely blessed to live within a 5-minute walk of Fish Creek Park, where I can have a glimpse of what was created before on this land and the sheer gratuitous beauty of God's wild places right here in Alberta. I used to think of this place as just an empty and cold land that was only good for its usefulness to us. And if given the option, I would happily go live somewhere else other than here, somewhere with beaches, somewhere much more green, somewhere I wouldn't have to worry about icy roads, or somewhere with better urban life and activities. I have lived a life of disconnection from this place that has been my homeland without me even realizing it. So in trying to form a more healed relationship to this truly beautiful place here in southern Alberta, to have the peace, the shalom of our God in my relationship to this land, I'm beginning to learn that it takes some serious attention and curiosity. Funny enough, those are the same skills it takes to grow a healthy relationship with human beings as well. A couple years ago, as this curiosity was beginning to awaken in me, I remember having a lunch with Pastor Lang Tang at the Calgary Chin Church, one of our sibling Mennonite congregations. I asked Lang to tell me about his homeland in Myanmar, and I could see him come alive as he recalled the mountainous region of the Chin province from where he came. He described how his mother would walk him through the forests there and point him and his siblings to the edible plants they could forage and bring home for their meals. He recalled how she would look out the window of their home, and simply by watching the tops of the trees and the height that the birds were flying at, she could accurately predict the weather that day. He told me about the different crops they would grow in their community. They had come to know that there were certain crops they could grow on one side of the mountain that were different from the other side. And they were so attuned to the rhythms and patterns of the land, even knowing that certain plants they grew would only germinate and grow the third year after planting. And he remembered that they would only cultivate crops on any bit of land for 7 years before moving to another place to allow the land to heal. I could see Pastor Lang being transported back home as he told not about the general beauty of his land of origin, but of the intimacy and particularity of those mountains upon which generations of his ancestors lived. With the right way of paying attention, God was revealing God's self to them through their land. There is, of course, a kind of connection here with many of our own ancestors, whether in the Mennonite church or outside of it. Mennonites, for example, are among other Christian traditions who have found themselves deeply involved in cultivating the land. In 2015, the Canadian Mennonite had this beautiful article that shared some of the intimacy Mennonites have had with the land and the plants that filled their gardens. It is an article about Susie Fisher, who was researching Mennonite Christians and their gardens for her doctoral thesis. I started realizing Mennonites don't talk easily about their emotions, Fisher says. Keen insight, I guess. Conversations drifted towards earthly things, trees, plants, gardens, tools, summer kitchens. Fisher discovered these very items of material culture contained the stories she was looking for. A lot of them had to do with the land So I thought, and this is her speaking, a lot of them had to do with the land. So I thought, why not write my whole dissertation on the garden? The article goes on to say that a year prior, Fisher bought an old house in the town of Gretna and moved into the heart of the West Reserve to better focus on her research. If I haven't said, that's in Manitoba, by the way. Since then, she's spent many an hour sitting in sunny kitchens, drinking coffee and talking to people about their gardens. That's when the stories come pouring out, she says. Stories of cuttings from a yellow rose bush brought over from Russia and confiscated by immigration officials. Of seeds sown into the hems of dresses and hidden in corsets. Of dolls stuffed with beans or wheat. People have shown her acorns believed to be descended from an 800-year-old oak in Ukraine known as the Chortitsa oak, as well as the seeds of melons, plums, marigolds, zinnias, and many other plants that once grew in Russian gardens. Mennonites who emigrated from Russia in the late 1800s left behind elaborately cultivated flower gardens and orchards that were central to community life. Russian Mennonites sometimes celebrated weddings and funerals in their gardens. Often family members were buried there. When the Mennonites came to Canada, they sought to recreate some of that culture here on the prairies. Although certainly under different circumstances than the Israelites being taken to Babylon thousands of years before, Mennonites certainly felt the gap in identity when they uprooted and settled here in Canada or elsewhere in a foreign land. One Mennonite gardener Fisher spoke to believes the Mennonites never really got over the trauma of their migration from Russia. She explains that he thinks the reason people have so much energy and care for the seeds is that they represent life, that the seeds are life manifest. While bringing stories and practices from home, God's provision and love through the land had to be patiently relearned in many ways. The seasons, the winds, the trees, the birds, the plants, it all needed to be listened to and understood in order to be a mutually sustaining relationship. Excuse me. This is, I think, close to what many of our Indigenous siblings are trying to explain to us when they share about how the land, plants, animals, and rivers speak to us. Perhaps this has less to do with auditory, mystical experiences and more to do with human beings being attentive to and curious in the created world in which God has placed us. If we humble ourselves and patiently pay attention, we can understand the ways in which God is beckoning us to live along with creation, cultivating it rather than destroying it. In the beautiful words of Simone Weil, quote, attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity. Absolutely unmixed attention is prayer. Absolutely unmixed attention is prayer, end quote. A prayerful life with our God involves paying attention not only to the needs of our families, our brothers and sisters and other human beings, but of the whole created world and the particular creation here where we call home, where the Bow River meets the Elbow River. None other than the great Canadian author Rudy Weeb, that infamous Mennonite disturber of the peace, has written so beautifully about this place in Alberta and even reflected upon the spirituality of this land. Hear this wonderful reflection from Rudy Weeb, quote, when my parents, my sister and I moved to southern Alberta, the Lethbridge, Coaldale area to be exact, from Saskatchewan, the English language changed drastically with the drastic landscape. I knew slough and muskeg and poplar and spruce, of course, and Saskatoon, but I knew nothing about coulee, chinook, cottonwood, sage, cactus. The native people had been inscrutable Cree, but in Alberta, their names carried the blunt aggression of Blackfoot and blood. The language of lakes and momentary creeks in spring runoff, and the swamps stuffed green with bulrushes for the red-winged blackbirds to sway on and nest, and all that stony soil that destroyed the back of any man riding his plow deep through the poplar and spruce bush of Saskatchewan became, in southern Alberta, the language of prairie, foothills, and mountains, and especially what to me seemed enormous muddy rivers carving their way through eroded valleys ever north and east towards an ocean. In Saskatchewan, I had never lived near a river, could not remember seeing one until I was taken to the hospital in North Battleford to have my awkward mislocated appendix removed. Only the school globe turning under my hand showed me where great rivers ran. And they are hard to imagine from spring creeks almost as hard as mountains out of poplar hills. But here, a whole vocabulary of not only landscape, but also of work faced you, in particular, sugar beets and irrigation. We suddenly lived beside a ditch running free all summer with thick water flickering past our house and connected somewhere to larger and larger ditches, dragged in straight patterns into the flat land until they joined many ditches, and finally the overland canal, and eventually, above us somewhere in the visible foothills, opened into a lake hidden behind a dam I could for years only imagine. But I always understood this liquid mud settling out in our cistern, this almost clear water which we skimmed off the top by pail with great gratitude, no need for wagon hauling barrels, always available and always free, it connected us to the high distant snow, sometimes visible on the southwest horizon. What I drank from our dipper was the immeasurable gift of the Rocky Mountains. Weeb goes on to reflect on the prairie here, quote, listen to in another way, prairie, the word, becomes two words, prayer and airy. Their bumpy head and knotted tail strung inextricably together to create a strange amalgam creature. Strangely enough, in the Judeo-Christian traditions many of us were born into, the movement of air we call wind is one evocative image for the divine, that spirit of God that breathes life into every creation and inspires, it quite literally inspirits or breathes into all creatures. Prairie, a landscape of airy prayer, indeed. There can be no doubt about it. After a lengthening spring or summer or fall day of walking in the wind, I know that I have been breathed into, whether I want to or not. And for the first time, I comprehend why the city climbed up out of the deep, protective Old Man River Valley and, despite its indenture to coal, built itself large on the unbounded and treeless prairie lying open to the distant mountains. It wanted the full blessing of the wind. To live in Lethbridge is to be perpetually inspired. End quote. Isn't that beautiful? These words are the fruit of a kind of deep attention to what the living, creating, redeeming God is doing here and now, around us, in this particular creation that holds us, where the prairie meets the mountains. I wonder if this attention to the land and this healing of relationship with creation is part of the mystery that Paul might be pointing to in Colossians chapter 1. He writes there that Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things, in heaven and on earth, were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. All things have been created through him and for him. He himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in everything. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace through the blood of his cross. To finish off today, and as we look to next weekend, where we will be gathering together more intimately with God's creation at Camp Vilaqua on the banks of the Little Red Deer River, I thought it might be appropriate to do a little localized translation of the psalm we heard this morning. For you, O Lord, have made me glad by your work. At the works of your hands, I sing for joy. The righteous flourish like the cottonwood and grow like a lodgepole pine in the foothills. They are planted in the house of the Lord. They flourish in the courts of our God. In old age, they still produce berry, cone, and catkin. They are always green and full of sap, showing that the Lord is upright. He is my rocky mountain, my Paskapoo sandstone. There is no unrighteousness in him. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.